On this episode of Women Behind Bars, one woman shot her husband after years of alleged abuse.
Mr. Johnson, he was laying on his back. He's saying to me, I've been shot. I can't breathe. I'm going to die.
I just lost it. I had the gun in the bedside table, and I just took out the gun and shot.
Then Rebecca Bivens tells her story. She was convicted of fatally attacking her 5-year-old stepdaughter.
The extent of her injuries were equivalent to dropping Danny out of a 40-story building.
Just the torture of knowing that you took a life, a 5-year-old life. And I have to live with that for the rest of my life.
Two women, two brutal crimes. These are the stories of Joellen Johnson and Rebecca Bivens. On February 25, 1991, in the wealthy seaside community of Solana Beach, California, sheriff's deputies responded to a 911 call. When they arrived on the scene, they found 46-year-old Patricia Joellen Johnson armed with a .38 revolver. Her husband, Peter Johnson, lay dying in their home, a bullet lodged in his back.
She said, I shot him because he's a he deserved it.
All of the abuse that he had put onto this woman for the 2 years he had been with her erupted that night into this moment of rapid fire shooting.
It was pretty cold-blooded and deliberate.
Was Patricia Joellen Johnson guilty of premeditated murder, or was this a crime of passion resulting from years of abuse? Patricia Joellen Johnson, who goes by Joellen, grew up in the small, idyllic community of Mattoon, Illinois, with her brother and parents.
She was a good child. She was very intelligent, very active. She's always been very athletic.
But when Joellen was just 6 years old, everything changed when her father left the family forever.
He was going to buy some cigarettes. He never came back, ever. He just left us.
We didn't know where he was for 9 years. Then we got word that he was in the Hines Veterans Hospital, and he died there a week later.
Life was very hard. It was a struggle. And I think that I never really dealt with the fact that my father walked out like that.
I think it affected her in a lot of ways. I think she was always afraid of being deserted again.
Despite losing her father, Joellen was an excellent student and went on to Eastern Illinois University and majored in English. There, she met her first husband, named Craig.
When she and Craig got married, they were still in college. They were married 21 years and had two sons, Tim and Ryan.
The couple lived in Houston, where Craig worked for NASA. The marriage seemed idyllic on the outside. But because her husband spent so much time traveling or on the golf course, Joellen felt abandoned. And after 21 years of marriage, the couple divorced. Months later, Joellen met and fell in love with her second husband, named Stan, a Navy officer who was stationed in San Diego.
When I first met Stan, he had a really outgoing, nice personality, and I assumed that's the way he was.
But it wasn't long after they were married that Joellen says Stan's personality changed.
He had a horrible temper.
I felt it was pretty volatile. She had some tough times with him and a lot of arguing over the telephone and coming into work with bruises on her arm.
Not only was he pushing me, shoving me, and one day he kicked me in the thigh.
It was after that she filed her divorce.
Though she had two failed marriages, Joellen was not giving up on love. In 1987, she answered a personal ad written by Peter Johnson, a twice-divorced biomedical executive who lived in Solana Beach, California.
Peter was amazing. He was outgoing, he was nice-looking, he was had a wonderful sense of humor, he was fun.
Peter Johnson was a very friendly, outgoing type of person, usually very happy and jolly, and easy to get along with, but highly respected.
Pete just swept Joellen off her feet.
Well, I was very impressed when I first met him the first time at the Christmas party, when Joellen brought him to the party. He was dressed in a $3,000 suit or more.
He had a ski condo in Utah, and we skied in Utah in the winter.
He had a Corvette, he had a boat. They went on trips all the time. Pete was very taken with Joellen.
We would stay weekends on the boat. It just sounded like the most wonderful life I could have imagined.
But some of Peter's friends were hesitant about the new relationship.
Pete had mentioned to my wife that he had met this lady, but she was a little concerned about it in that this lady carried a loaded gun in her purse at all times.
I'd had a gun since 1972 because my first husband traveled a lot. We lived in Houston. I had two little kids at the time.
Joellen and Peter moved in together, but she claims the good times were short-lived.
When I moved in with him, it just became so apparent that he was seeing a lot of other women. He traveled quite a bit. Every time he flew from the East Coast back to California, he would stop over in Salt Lake City. And he wouldn't tell me why or anything, and I wasn't supposed to ask.
He'd get cards in the mail from women. He'd get phone calls from women. He wouldn't come home at night.
She'd find women's underwear under the seat in the car.
Suspicious that Peter was seeing other women, the prosecution claims Joellen also began to exhibit destructive behaviors.
She was paranoid. She was also obsessive, extremely, extremely jealous. And when those personalities met up against one another, it ultimately provided a very volatile mix.
The prosecution also asserts, based on testimony, that despite Peter's idiosyncrasies, he was considered by people close to him to be quite decent.
Witnesses that knew him well, said he was a kind, compassionate man, very intelligent man, but there were very few people that were very close to him, other than Mrs. Johnson, that had bad things to say about him.
Still, Joellen was intent on proving her suspicions about Peter's infidelities.
I hired a private detective in Salt Lake. The detective followed him, and he had a girlfriend in Salt Lake. So when he came back, we argued about that and everything. He would never admit it, even though I had pictures. So I was going to leave, but I stayed.
After 2 years of trying to make the relationship work, Joellen left Peter and went to Florida. But Joellen says that Peter then aggressively pursued her, and a year later, they got back together.
I thought he had changed so dramatically, and I was deliriously happy. I thought that he realized he loved me, couldn't live without me. He kept saying, I'm the new 1990 Pete Johnson.
In 1990, 3 years into their turbulent relationship, Peter and Joellen Johnson were married. But soon after, Joellen says that Peter's behavior became increasingly controlling and bizarre.
We'd had a prenuptial agreement that we both worked on and both agreed to, but he kept revising the prenuptial agreement, and he kept asking me for a full financial disclosure. I would read these things, and I'd say, I can't sign this. I don't have any money.
He was always demanding money from her, even though he out-earned her by like 5 to 1.
He was controlling. He had some obsessive tendencies. He would keep lists and things like that. Would question people who questioned him in relationships.
They would go on trips, according to testimony, and he would charge her like $3 for an aspirin.
This was a two-sided affair from the very beginning, where both of these people went back and forth at each other, and it was a relationship that was doomed from the start.
Soon after getting married, Joellen claims Peter started making lists of his wife's actions.
He got to the point that whenever I did something he didn't like, he'd say, you're making the list.
And he established a system that if she violated, she would be punished.
The ultimate punishment was his complete withdrawal of his love and affection for her. And he would be allowed to spend 8 hours, 4 or 8 hours, doing whatever he wanted without having to explain to her what he was doing.
Not only was he keeping lists, I had rules I had to follow. He was making behavior charts on graph paper, things I did wrong.
She became engaged in this constant pattern of trying to make sure that she would please him and wouldn't violate the rules that he was establishing.
I really had no confidence in my own judgment anymore.
9 months after getting married, Joellen left her husband for the second time, but she says Peter convinced her to come back. It would be a decision she would regret for the rest of her life. When Women Behind Bars continues.
I just lost it. I had the gun in the bedside table. I just took out the gun and shot.
By 1991, Joellen Johnson says her marriage to her third husband, Peter, was becoming increasingly volatile. On February 25th, Joellen found a disturbing letter from her husband on their kitchen table.
It was this final demand for money, and it said that I was in arrears over $3,000. And from that point on, I had to pay all my own expenses and half of all the living expenses.
Joellen says she did have a job as a medical secretary and was already paying a lot of her own expenses.
Well, I called him at work. I said, I hope this is a joke. And he said, no, it's not.
When Peter got home that night, Joellen questioned him about the note.
We started, arguing about this bill. And he was telling me that he was thinking of the ultimate punishment. The argument escalated, and he decided to go to bed right in the middle of it.
According to Joellen, she couldn't sleep and went into the bedroom to talk to her husband.
I was totally distraught. Before he got home, I had called an attorney in Delmar. And I was going to take her copies of all these documents he had produced to me and the behavior charts and some of the other things I had. I just wanted to get an outside assessment of all this craziness.
As Joellen told her husband of her plan to go to the lawyer, the argument escalated.
He said if I went, then just file for divorce because he wanted a divorce. Well, I didn't want a divorce, as stupid as it sounds now. I wanted the marriage to work. I kept trying to get him to talk. I said, at least kiss me goodnight so I can go to sleep. And then he finally turned over and mashed his mouth against mine and cut my lip. And I just lost it. I just picked up the phone and called 911. Pete jumped up and pulled the phone out of the wall.
The dispatcher called the Solana Beach unit to check on a 911 hangup. The dispatcher further stated that there was a woman that was on the phone, dialed 911. She heard a male's voice in the background, and then the phone went dead.
He was really, really mad. He was saying, this is it, it's over. He was getting clothes to put on. He was in the closet, and I said, don't leave. And I just lost it. I had the gun in the bedside table, and I took it out. I was standing across a queen-size bed from him, and he was at a closet, and I just took out the gun and shot. He didn't indicate that he was hurt. He was yelling and really, really angry, and he was like pacing. And so to get out of the door, I had to go by him. And so when I went by him, I shot him in the arm.
The first shot that she fired with her .38 revolver, she pointed at him from about a distance of 4 feet, ripped into his back, ripped through his liver, his lung, his kidney, and caused the major damage to the internal organs.
My heart was pounding. I remember running down the hallway after I shot him in the arm, and I was looking back because I had the feeling that he was chasing me. And I ran out the door.
Upon arrival at the scene, a female came out of the condominium wearing her pink robe. I noticed she had a weapon in her hand.
I was so confused, and they told me, I don't know how many times, yelled at me to put my gun down.
I drew my weapon and I ordered her to comply by dropping the weapon, and I told her, I threatened that I will have to shoot her.
Joellen finally put down the gun and responded to Deputy Yerkes's orders. After subduing her, Yerkes entered the condominium looking for the victim.
At that point, she blurted out a statement. Oh, he's on the bed. I shot him. I hope he dies. He deserves it. I immediately restrained her, had my partner come up the stairs real quick. We both had heard some groaning and moaning and as if someone was in pain. Mr. Johnson's laying on his back. There's a pool of blood on the left-hand side of him. And later I saw a little bit around the stomach area and that he's saying to me, I've been shot. I can't breathe. I'm going to die. She had said, why don't you close the door? I don't want to hear him whining about dying.
While the deputy sheriff tried to stop the bleeding, paramedics showed up to administer aid to Mr. Johnson. But it would be too late. Peter Johnson died at the hospital 2 hours after he was shot by his wife.
I couldn't believe that I had killed him, and I still loved him. I couldn't believe that Pete could be dead.
Joellen was arrested and charged with first-degree murder. In the courtroom, a jury heard about Peter's alleged taunting and sadistic behavior. But at the time Joellen's case went to trial in 1991, a woman could not legally use her husband's abuse as part of her defense.
They didn't see how those facts played into why she would kill him that final night.
I had no defense, basically. My attorney said that we couldn't put the victim on trial.
Then the prosecution presented their case.
I argued at the trial that was premeditation and deliberation. She had an opportunity to think about life, an opportunity to think about death, and she chose death.
I feel it would be a heinous crime as it was pretty cold-blooded and deliberate, and she's deserving of what she was going to get and as far as sentencing is concerned.
I got the worst sentence I could have gotten.
I believe that Pat Johnson got off very lightly for the murder of Pete Johnson.
Oh, I just thought I was gonna die right there in the courtroom.
Joellen was sent to the California Institution for Women. But 12 years later, in 2002, the law changed to recognize battered women's syndrome as a legitimate defense. Joellen took up her own cause.
I filed a writ. And my conviction was completely overturned. So they retried me.
And the law changed to allow for experts to testify. And that's what was lacking in Joellen Johnson's first trial, was an expert who was trained to understand how does domestic violence result in the death of someone and not be murder.
The relationship between Patricia Joellen Johnson and Pete Johnson really fit the criterion of a classic abusive relationship. He was in the role of what we call the coercive control dominated offender, abusing and controlling the victim. He'd grab her face, he would shake her, he hit a racquetball at her, he forced a milkshake down her throat. He would blatantly cheat, and then he would blame her jealousy for causing the problems in their relationship. This is classic crazy-making behavior, and this was a very calculated, systematic attempt to do this.
In trial, we tried to make it clear that this wasn't just a situation where Peter Johnson was the big bad villain who was constantly abusing this poor woman, that she also would, in her own obsessive and jealous and manipulative ways, abuse him. I argued in 2006 that this was first degree murder because Mrs. Johnson had a gun. She knew where the gun was. She kept it in a nightstand. She kept it loaded. She had to think about where she was aiming the gun. She aimed it directly at his back, hit her target. Then after hitting her target, didn't stop and say, you know, oh my goodness, what did I do to the man I love? Calmly, coolly walked around the bed, fired another shot at him. While he had his arm up in a defensive posture, she walked around the bed, pointed the gun at him again, and shot him in the arm. She took dead aim not once, but twice, and he died from bleeding that surgeons couldn't stop approximately 90 minutes after she shot him.
Here she was on the stand, this grandmotherly-looking woman who had had this country club life and was college-educated, and the victim is an executive. These weren't people who you would expect to be in a murder trial.
It was our hope the jury would understand that all of the abuse that he had put onto this woman for the 2 years he had been with her, the emotional and psychological abuse, erupted that night into this moment of
rapid fire shooting that was done in the heat of passion, and she should be convicted of a voluntary manslaughter and not murder.
We called a mental health expert who clearly acknowledged that there was abuse from Mr. Johnson to Mrs. Johnson, that there was, it was serious abuse, but what we disagreed with, that it was one-sided abuse. Joellen suspected that Mr. Johnson was cheating on her. She would check up on him all the time.
Several weeks into Joellen's second trial, the case went to the jury. When Women Behind Bars continues.
Second-degree murder comes with intent. So the jury clearly felt that she intended to do this.
And later in this episode of Women Behind Bars, a woman is accused of fatally attacking her 5-year-old stepdaughter.
All I could think to myself was, oh my God, she's dead.
In 2006, Joellen Johnson, while still in prison, was on trial for the second time for murdering her wealthy husband, Peter Johnson. Joellen claimed she shot him after years of psychological and emotional abuse. But this jury also came back with a verdict of guilty, convicting her of second-degree murder. She received a sentence of 15 years to life.
Second-degree murder comes with intent. So the jury clearly felt that she intended to do this. They clearly did not buy the argument that she was driven to it.
I was very disappointed when they came back with second degree. By law, any sentence with a life on it in California is almost impossible to get out of prison.
We were very pleased with the verdict. We've always felt that this was a murder. She was convicted of murder in 1991. That was overturned. She was convicted again of murder in 2006, albeit second degree murder.
And it was sad to see this woman continue to be traumatized by being convicted of murder when it really wasn't murder.
I believe an appropriate sentence for Pat Johnson would have been capital punishment.
After the trial, Joellen was returned to the California Institution for Women, located an hour outside Los Angeles.
The hardest thing to get used to in prison was just, of course, not having any freedom. I was in group therapy, and the mental health department helped me a lot. It's hard for me to accept that I did what I did, that I shot him. I see how things just spiraled out of control. And it was my fault too. I feel bad that so many lives have been affected. It never should have happened, and no one deserves to die.
Over the years, Joellen has had a rough adjustment to prison life.
It's taken a long time to get used to living in here. But finally, I think I've mastered it. I've been a so-called model prisoner. I have no disciplinary write-ups. I've done everything I'm supposed to do. I've done volunteer work.
Joellen's volunteer work includes helping to train dogs for the disabled.
I'm in the dog program, which I really, really like. And some of the changes I saw in women lifers when the dogs came in, it was really amazing. It's the greatest program I could imagine in a prison. I just love it.
As she waits for yet another appeal, Joellen stays in touch with her sons from her first marriage through letters. She also talks to her mother weekly. She says she won't give up hope that someday she will be free.
Joellen Johnson's case is on appeal right now, and that will take a number of years to go through. She also has a parole hearing in 3 years.
It's not that I don't think I should be punished and that I don't, and I, it's not that at all. I just think that I think I've served enough time. I still have some hope, you know, that justice will prevail.
Next up on Women Behind Bars.
She was the center of our life, and if she wasn't there, it wasn't worth it no more.
For more information about Women Behind Bars, go to www.wetv.com. On Tuesday, November 17th, 1998, 31-year-old Rebecca Bivens rushed her stepdaughter, Danny Bivens, to the emergency room. The 5-year-old was unconscious and clinging to life.
The extent of her injuries, which were blunt force trauma, were equivalent to, you know, dropping Danny out of a 40-story building.
Rebecca soon confessed to the crime, and police discovered that throughout her life, Rebecca had a history of emotional problems and violent outbursts.
When you look at mental illness and violence and you add them together, it's a formula that dispels disaster.
Was Rebecca guilty of killing her stepdaughter in a vicious rage? Or was her mental illness to blame for the psychotic snap? Rebecca Bivens was raised in the small, close-knit community of Streeter, Illinois.
I grew up in a good home. My mom and dad were, you know, both there. They weren't divorced.
Her father worked for a glass manufacturer, and her mother was active in the Baptist Church.
Their home was sort of the second home of a lot of the kids in the youth group. They were the surrogate parents of a lot of those children who came from dysfunctional homes.
I have a brother, so it was me and my brother. He's younger than me.
From a young age, there were signs that she was a troubled girl.
I think my mom and my dad knew something was wrong, but they just didn't know exactly what was wrong.
Becky was rather emotionally oriented. She'd respond rather sharply to many emotional situations, conflicts with some of her friends.
Real bad mood swings. And the mood swings sometimes were very angry. Sometimes I cried a lot, hopeless.
At age 14, Rebecca was drawn into a secret romance with a 19-year-old cousin who was visiting for the summer.
I was looking for love, and I was going to find it, whether it was good or bad.
When summer ended, Rebecca's cousin moved back home to another state, leaving the 14-year-old pregnant.
I had an abortion because my mom made me. That was very hard for me, and then it was even harder because I was never allowed to talk about it.
Rebecca describes the relationship with her mother as strained.
It was a constant battle. She wouldn't let me date because she was afraid that I was going to get pregnant again. My mom, does she love me? Yeah, she loves me. But has she always loved me? I don't think so.
By the time she was 18, Rebecca was married.
Her and her mother had a conflict of some kind. Becky left home and went to the county courthouse and married Alan, her first husband.
That's why I married Al. I married Al to get out of the house.
Rebecca soon gave birth to a daughter and embraced motherhood.
I guess it's the unconditional love. They love you no matter what. To have that little person depend on you and worship you, and it's just beyond words.
But according to Rebecca, the marriage was filled with constant fighting. After 21 months, the couple divorced, and Rebecca soon married Larry Muller, with whom she had three more children.
Larry was my soulmate. He loved me. He worshiped me. It just felt right.
Rebecca admits her mental instability created friction with her second husband.
I mean, he tried. I wasn't easy to live with. Lord knows I wasn't easy to live with.
Yeah, Becca had a history of being aggressive. If somebody would say something, that she might just jump across the table and grab them, you know, grab them by the neck, you know.
Whenever she would find a situation too unbearable emotionally, and it usually involved family situations, there would be violence.
Rebecca remembers going through extreme emotional highs.
Be nothing 3-4 o'clock in the morning washing walls and singing and dancing.
And then suffering debilitating lows.
The depressive stage was horrible. I didn't want to live. I couldn't eat. I couldn't sleep. Life was horrible.
People didn't really understand mental illness, and they probably thought, hey, that's the way that Becca is.
Her unchecked erratic behavior continued until, at age 25, she suddenly walked out on her husband and children and disappeared for months.
They say I had a psychotic breakdown. I don't remember 3-4 months of my life. It was like I woke up one day and I didn't know where I was or who I was with.
When Rebecca's mother and husband found her in a nearby town, they brought her home and checked her into a local hospital for psychiatric evaluation. Doctors diagnosed her with bipolar disorder and borderline personality disorder.
It was a relief. I've been waiting for those answers for 25 years. That's chemical that I can't help, that I can't control.
After Rebecca was diagnosed, she was released from the hospital with prescription drugs designed to control her intense mood swings.
They put me on a whole bunch of meds. Prozac was one of them. Lithium was another. Corgard to control the anger episodes.
But Rebecca claims the pills made her feel lethargic and worn out, so she stopped taking her medication. As a result, she would sink into severe depressions.
There were times when at least 2, 3, maybe 4 different times when she tried to commit suicide, taking an overdose of pills.
Rebecca was hospitalized 4 times over the next 2 years, but each time she was released back home, she failed to continue her medication. She would then relapse into manic depressive episodes.
I was not a very nice person. I was drinking, I was having sex with whoever wanted to have sex with me. Didn't too much take care of my kids.
After 6 years of marriage, her behavior finally pushed her husband Larry to the brink. According to Rebecca, he pulled a shotgun on her one night when she was in bed with their baby daughter.
It just so happened that he was so drunk when he loaded the gun, he jammed the bullet, and that's what saved our life.
In 1995, approximately 2 years after the shotgun incident, the couple divorced and their 4 children went to live with relatives. Rebecca says she continued her self-destructive path of sex, alcohol, and drugs.
She met fellows in taverns who had their own problems, and she more deeply involved herself in that kind of life.
Violence was pretty much part of her life. Numerous calls at the residence, you know, for domestic issues with, you know, Rebecca's husbands or living boyfriends at that time.
After a 3rd failed marriage that lasted 11 months, Rebecca met her 4th husband, Chad Bivens, in 1996. She soon found herself in another marriage she claims was abusive.
He would get mad over the easiest, littlest things.
A 1997 police report confirms that the police were called to the Bivens' home for domestic abuse.
He had had this reputation for violence.
Rebecca says she again did not take her meds because she felt she could deal better with her husband's alleged temper without them.
Life was easier to handle without the medicine. The beatings, they didn't seem to hurt as bad.
The one bright spot in Rebecca's life, she says, was taking care of Chad's 5-year-old daughter, Danny.
She was a girly girl. She liked her hair done, you know, curled. She was just full of life, just bubbly and happy-go-lucky.
Chad and Rebecca had recently obtained full custody of Danny from his previous wife.
Rebecca seemed to really care for Danny. She had her dressed really nice and her hair was always done really nice.
I love Danny more than life itself.
But without the stabilizing effects of medication, Rebecca was a ticking time bomb.
She had the bipolar disorder, also the borderline personality disorder, which rage is a common component of that. So she had all these things going on, plus a violent environment, so the amount of raids that she would have would be substantial.
Rebecca says the morning started out stressfully.
Me and Chad had been fighting for days. I hadn't had no sleep. I was at my wits' ends with him. Chad went to work at 6 o'clock.
She was trying to get Danny ready to go to daycare, and so she was started drawing the water in the bathtub. She remembers walking towards Danny's bedroom.
From her statement to the police, she had said that she had told Danny to stop jumping on the bed and to make her bed, and that Danny had said, "You can't make me, you're not my mommy."
What happened next was a brutal attack that shocked a community. Next up on Women Behind Bars.
Just knowing that you took a life, a 5-year-old life, and I have to live with that for the rest of my life.
In the late 1990s, in a small town in Illinois, 31-year-old Rebecca Bivens was struggling with mental illness that included intense anger and manic episodes. By 1998, she had been in and out of psychiatric hospitals and says she was trapped in an abusive marriage and losing control. The morning of November 17th, Rebecca was getting 5-year-old stepdaughter Danny Bivens ready for school. Police say what followed was an unspeakable act of rage.
The last thing I remember is running her bathwater, and that's it. So from 8:30 to about 10:30, I have no recollection of what happened.
Rebecca claims her next memory is finding the little girl injured and unconscious on the floor.
All I could think to myself was, oh my God, she's dead. So I picked her up and I took her to the emergency room. I was crying. I was devastated.
Danny was transported by helicopter to the trauma center at Children's Hospital of Illinois in Peoria.
They induced a coma to see if the swelling would go down in her brain.
In the late morning hours, by a social worker from St. Francis Medical Center in Peoria, Illinois, that they had a 5-year-old girl there with head trauma injuries.
Police questioned Rebecca about her actions that morning.
Rebecca stated that after she had got Danny up for school, she went down to wash some clothes, and she heard a loud bang, so she came running upstairs, and Danny comes out of her bedroom saying, "Mommy, I fell down," and then she just collapsed on the floor.
Police didn't buy her story. Investigators went to the house to piece together what happened to Danny.
If she was bouncing on a bed, she would have hit the ceiling tile, which would have caused no injuries at all. So right away, we suspected other objects in that household might have been used to cause the severity of the injuries to Danny.
Despite the doctor's best efforts to save her life, Danny Bivens never recovered. On November 18th, 24 hours after her arrival in Peoria, little Danny was taken off life support.
We pulled the plug Wednesday afternoon.
Becky was devastated. She was devastated.
She was the center of our life, and it wasn't worth living no more. If she wasn't there, it wasn't worth it no more.
The pathologist, you know, informed us that the extent of her injuries, which were blunt force trauma, were equivalent to, you know, dropping Danny out of a 40-story building.
The next day after Danny's death, Rebecca came in to police headquarters.
She basically came in and confessed to what happened. Her and Danny were having a little problems that morning as far as getting Danny ready for school. Danny comes out and says, "You're not my mother." And right away, Rebecca gets all upset about it. She grabs Danny, throws her against the love seat, which Danny strikes and wouldn't handle. She falls to the floor.
She was in a state of manic rage, throwing, destroying, shouting, unable to stop.
Rebecca picks Danny up again and throws her across the room again, picks her up, and then starts banging her head on a wooden coffee table.
Rebecca insists to this day she doesn't remember any details about the beating or giving a confession to police.
I don't remember telling them that, but I must have told them something.
Police arrested Bivens and she was locked up at a local jail to await trial.
Danny's death was very shocking to the community in general. There was outrage. There was a lot of anger.
It was the talk of the beauty parlors and bar rooms. People thinking, you know, what an awful person. She doesn't deserve any mercy.
The emotional stakes were so high that they could not stand on both sides to be supportive of Becky while lamenting the death of Danny.
Initially, I'd hoped for the death penalty. If anyone's deserving of the death penalty, it's someone who's capable of throwing a 5-year-old girl around a room like a sack of potatoes and killing her.
But prosecutors knew Rebecca's mental state would come into play and chose not to pursue the death penalty.
Rebecca had a very hard time processing what had happened.
Rebecca's defense attorney was concerned his client was not fit to assist in her own defense.
She didn't quite remember what happened during the period. Her rocking back and forth and maybe not really focusing on what I was saying.
But psychiatrists evaluated Rebecca and she was found fit to stand trial.
Her best defense was to try and do an insanity defense, which is extremely difficult in Illinois.
Dr. Robert Chapman, after evaluating Rebecca on behalf of the defense, testified that she was legally insane during the murder.
Thoughts were racing, jumping.
She was unable to think as we know thinking. She could not appreciate the wrongfulness of her act.
It was like I woke up from a dream and she wasn't moving. I don't even remember what I was doing physically. I just remember seeing her.
People in an acute manic state have an amnesia many times for what happened at that time. Their thoughts are so disorganized and so scattered, so flight of ideas, that they really don't have a good memory for it.
Prosecutors didn't deny Rebecca had mental problems.
What we were saying is, yes, she's mentally ill. We know she's mentally ill, but that doesn't mean she doesn't know what she's doing.
The prosecution presented Rebecca's initial claim to doctors and police that Danny's injuries came from jumping on the bed, but she contradicted this story when she later confessed to police that she had killed Danny.
We thought, gotcha. The fact that she lied about what had happened to Danny was our strongest suit. You don't lie unless you know you're guilty. Unless you're culpable of offense, you wouldn't bother to make up a lie.
Dr. Chapman testified that because of her memory gaps, Rebecca made false statements to bridge those gaps.
She had a blank space, and she just was trying to fill it in because she had no information of what really happened because she couldn't remember.
The jury came back guilty but mentally ill. I was disappointed. I think the public in general doesn't understand. That meant that she was going to prison.
I think some crimes are just beyond the pale, and people say, well, I don't really care if she's mentally ill or not. You know, that was such a horrific crime. I don't care.
Rebecca was sentenced to life in prison, but a later appeal reduced her time to 40 years. She is currently incarcerated at a maximum security center in Eastern Illinois.
I think I've made a life for myself in here. I just try to do positive things. I take my medication. I go to the beauty school. Prison saved my life, because if I would have stayed out there, I don't think I would have made it.
Little Danny Bivens has not been forgotten.
Danny Bivens was buried in a cemetery actually across the street from a preschool where she was going.
Town still remembers the Bivens case, and they remember Danny. It was a tragedy that shocked our town.
Shortly after Danny's death, a child advocacy center was named for her and another child who was also a victim of child abuse. It's called the Danny Brandon Center.
By having the center named for her, puts kids first, and that's what needs to happen.
Rebecca's oldest child is now an adult. The three younger children live with their grandmother in another state, too far away to visit. But Rebecca writes and calls to stay in contact with them. Rebecca still struggles with the terrible crime she committed that November morning.
I did what I did. But being mentally ill had a lot to do with it.
I believe everybody deserves redemption, but what she did was serious, and there are serious consequences.
Some things I wish I would remember, because I would like to know exactly what happened, and then some days I don't want to know what happened.
But I think basically she does know exactly what happened that, you know, fatal morning with Danny Bivens.
When you look at a picture, you see a life there. You see a potential there, and then you realize it's gone.
I have done more to myself than anybody could ever do to me. I have beat myself up. I have just the torture of knowing that you took a life, a 5-year-old life. And I have to live with that for the rest of my life.